the atrocities were horrific. In those couple of hours, 67 unarmed Jewish men, women, and children, including infants, were slaughtered.
We have a long fight ahead of us.
Here I am.
Here I am.
Here I am.
And here I am.
Here I am.
And here I am.
And here I am. We shall never die.
My guest today is an award-winning freelance journalist and the author of a new book called Ghosts of a Holy War, the 1929 massacre in Palestine that ignited the Arab-Israeli conflict. I'm delighted to say here I am with Yardena Schwartz.
Thanks so much, Shai. It's so great to be here.
Thank you for being here. Thank you for writing this book. And I really want to delve into this. Before I do, I'm going to start with the same question I start every episode, which is, Yardena Schwartz, what kind of a Jew are you?
Wow. So I am a Jew who is unapologetic and proud and outspoken.
Have you always been the outspoken Jew?
I think so. I mean, I grew up going to a Jewish day school until I was bat mitzvahed. And then I went to public school so I went from being in a place where I had only Jewish friends and knew only Jewish people to a place where I was one of, if not the only Jews in the entire school or my class. And I never shied away from talking about it. My name was Yardena Schwartz, so I couldn't really get away
from it. It's really complicated to hide your Jewishness with Yardena Schwartz.
And my middle name is Yocheved, so Yardena Yocheved Schwartz. There was no hiding from that. And, you know, even going to public school, I did USY, I did
What's
Jewish
USY
summer camp.
For people listening in?
So USY is United Synagogue Youth. It's kind of like maybe similar to BBYO or Young Judea. A youth organization. They would do Shabbatons on the weekends or, you know, different events where young, middle school, high school students get together. And in the summers, I went to Najua and Cedar Lake. That was a summer camp in the Poconos. Not religious, but Jewish, Zionist. And I grew up having a family in Israel. I didn't actually go to Israel for the first time until I was 18 on a Young Judea program. But every summer and throughout the year, cousins of mine from Israel would visit us. So I always had this connection to Israel. And when I studied abroad in college, I did a session in Argentina and a semester also in Tel Aviv. And that was when I decided I was going to eventually make Aliyah. And I finally did that in 2013, a couple years after graduating from Columbia Journalism School. And I moved to Tel Aviv and ended up living there for 10 years and just moved back to the States about a year and a half ago.
Wow. So that's a really interesting transition from Jewish day school, public high school, you know, going on some trips to Israel, making Aliyah, living 10 years in Israel, then coming back here to the United States. But there is a moment that I would say, and you describe it in the book, where you visited Israel before, but there was a pivotal moment that changed kind of like your trajectory and that's based on a class that you took at Columbia Journalism School. What was that class? We're going to get into the book, but what was that class and what was that visit?
Yeah, well, that class and that visit is a great way to get into the book because I actually, you know, kind of start with my journey into Hebron with that trip I took in 2011. I was a student at Columbia Journalism School and I was in a very small class called Covering Religion. It's led by Professor Ari Goldman, a veteran religion correspondent for the New York Times, now a veteran professor at Columbia Journalism School. He still leads this class, Covering Religion. And every year he brings his class to some kind of hotbed of religious conflict. So some years they go to India or Ireland. I think this year he's taking his class to Ireland. He used to take his class very often to Israel and the West Bank. For obvious reasons, he hasn't done that in the last couple years. But in our year, it was 2011, we spent 10 days in Israel and the West Bank covering stories of our choosing. I had chosen to cover efforts to teach Arabic to Israeli school children who at the time weren't learning Arabic. They were learning English and Hebrew. And so I did my reporting in Haifa and in other parts of Israel. But there were certain trips that all of us took as a class, and one of those was to Hebron. And our trip to Hebron was led by an organization called Breaking the Silence. It's an organization founded by Israeli soldiers who had served in Hebron and wanted Israelis to know what was being done in the name of security in Hebron. For instance, you know, heavy restrictions of movement for Palestinians who live there, you know, checkpoints, raids into randomly chosen Palestinians' homes at night, and beatings sometimes of those who resisted. And I was really struck by that trip to Hebron because, you know, I'd spent more time in Israel than any other classmate on that trip. I was the only one who had actually spent time in Israel among my classmates. And so I knew more about the country than anybody else in my class did, and yet I had never been to Hebron. And what I saw there really disturbed me. You know, we were walking down Shuhada Street, which is, you know, not all of it is off limits to Palestinians, but what was once the most, the busiest, most bustling part of the old city of Hebron is now essentially off limits to Palestinians who live there. So, you know, Palestinians who live on this street have to kind of like go through other streets to get to their homes. And, you know, I had spent all of my life, you know, learning about Israel and spending time there. And I hadn't known what was happening in Hebron. And that trip really opened my eyes to things that I ended up doing more digging into. I mean, during that day in Hebron, we visited the grave of Baruch Goldstein, who perpetrated a massacre in 1994 in which 29 Muslim men and boys were killed. And I had known about Baruch Goldstein's massacre. What I didn't know until that day in Hebron was that he was revered by many Jews who live in Hebron today. You know, his tombstone was covered in rocks of, you know, mourning and reverence. And, you know, we met an Israeli who was living there who tried to have our class kicked out of Hebron. He tried, you know, calling soldiers to get us to leave simply because our professors were telling us about what Baruch Goldstein had done and the Kahanist ideology that he had been inspired by. And so, yeah, I mean, that was essentially my first visit to Israel as a journalist and not as, you know, a young Zionist. And so it really informed my time in Israel as a journalist and as a Zionist, you know, how to kind of thread that needle and how to approach these stories with the eyes of a journalist and kind of, you know, maybe check any kind of biases I had had going into my work. You know, I think.
But I find something really interesting in what you said, because a lot of people coming in would see the state of affairs at Hebron now. And if I'm not mistaken, the Jewish side or the Jewish areas of Hebron are severely limited to the Palestinians. And the Palestinians' side of Hebron is not just limited, it's off limits to the Jews, right? So there's this huge, I would say, segregation on both sides. Both sides don't want the other side in. It's not just one or the other. Then you went, you know, and you go deeper and you go to 1994, Baruch Goldstein and the massacre. A lot of people would stop the story there and say, okay, you know, so there's a clear evil, there's a clear good side, and that's the story. But then you decided, okay, I'm going to go deeper and I'm going to go and see what Hebron was like. How did we get to this point? What was Hebron like in 1936? What was it like in 1929? How did we get here? Why not stop at the point where it's easy?
Well, you raise a really good point. And I think that was one thing, I mean, one of many things that was missing from that trip in 2011. They didn't tell us about how Hebron had come to this. We weren't told that once Hebron was not this antithesis of coexistence that it is today. It was once a beacon of coexistence, a place where Jews and Muslims had lived side by side in peace for generations. And they also didn't tell us that 80% of the city of Hebron is not only overseen by the Palestinian Authority, but like you said, is completely off limits to Jews. And the 20% that is overseen by Israel, the Israelis who live there actually only have access to about 3% of it. And the vast majority of the residents of both of these sides of Hebron are Arab Palestinians. So the city of Hebron, you know, we often hear about it as if it's just that tiny part of the street that's off limits to Palestinians. Yet Hebron is the largest Palestinian city in the West Bank. It is the economic center of the Palestinian Authority. It's home to nearly 300,000 Palestinians. And I thought that all of these things that were left out of that tour in Hebron in 2011, once I started learning about them, as I reported in Hebron for my book, I felt like all of those little pieces of history that have been left out of our dialogue, not only around Hebron, but around the conflict itself, are really telling and revealing of all of the aspects of history that have been often left out of the dialogue around this conflict. And I thought that the kind of spark of this conflict, ground zero of this conflict, as I learned from my research, really was this massacre in Hebron that ended this period of history in which Hebron was this beacon of coexistence and kind of put us on this trajectory, which we are sadly still in today, in which Hebron is the epicenter of this conflict, and the disinformation and incitement that fueled the massacre of 1929 continues to fuel this conflict today.
So let's talk before we get to the bad. Let's always start with the good. What was this beacon of coexistence?
So in 1929, Hebron was home to this very small but very thriving, pious Jewish community of about 800 people. Around half of the Jews living in Hebron at the time were Ashkenazi, and about half were Sephardi, Mizrahi, Arabic-speaking Jews. And what led me to write about this Jewish community in 1929 was the discovery in Memphis, Tennessee, of all places, of a box of letters written by a young man from Memphis who had gone to Hebron. Jewish American man who had gone to Hebron in 1928 to study Torah and to study at what was at the time the most prestigious yeshiva in Palestine, the Hebron Yeshiva. It was also known as the Slobodka Yeshiva because it was the new branch of the Slobodka Yeshiva from Lithuania that had relocated to Hebron in 1925. And this young
man—
Why
did it relocate, just by the way? Because—
So in 1924, the Lithuanian government decided that it would start drafting yeshiva students in Lithuania, and Lithuanian rabbis did not want their students to be drafted into the Lithuanian army. So they kind of panicked and tried to think of, you know, where they could go. And at the time, today we know of so many European yeshivas, Eastern European yeshivas that went from Eastern Europe to whether it was at the time Palestine or Eretz Yisrael. And at the time, the Slobodka Yeshiva was the first of the Eastern European yeshivas to relocate to what was then Palestine, to Eretz Yisrael. So it kind of started this trend in not just Lithuania, but other parts of Eastern Europe of these, you know, very historic, prestigious yeshivot to relocate to Palestine.
But it wasn't out of Zionism or the self-determination of the Jewish peoplehood.
So with Slobodka, it's tricky because the head of the yeshiva in Hebron, Mordechai Epstein, he actually was an early Zionist, an early religious Zionist, as you would call him today. Mm-hmm. But the spark of them relocating wasn't Zionism. It was this draft order by the Lithuanian government. In the end, the Lithuanian government rescinded that draft order. And so there continued to be a Slobodka yeshiva in Slobodka, Lithuania, but it now had this other counterpart in Hebron. And they chose Hebron because they had scouted out other locations in Palestine at the time. They considered Jerusalem, Rehovot, and it was between, I think, Rishon LeZion and Hebron in the end that were vying for the attention of the yeshiva heads. And the Jewish leaders of Hebron, Eliezer Dan Slonim and his father, the Ashkenazi chief rabbi of Hebron, Yaakov Yosef Slonim, they convinced the yeshiva to choose Hebron because it was this beacon of peace in Palestine. It was considered one of the safest place to be a Jew in Palestine. It hadn't been attacked in previous outbreaks of violence that had affected other parts of Palestine, such as the Jewish community of Jerusalem or in Jaffa. There had been riots in Jerusalem and Jaffa in 1920 and 1921, and those riots hadn't affected the Jews of Hebron because of these remarable relations between—
We should say the riots were violent riots. Like, people were murdered.
Yes.
Yud Lamed Peretz was like a famous author. But— I don't want to be too negative, but let's not paint a too beautiful, rosy view of coexistence, because this is something I learned about in your book, about the seventh step. Even while there was coexistence, there was this thing about the seventh step. What is that?
So yeah, I mean, when I say peaceful, I don't mean that there was equality by any means. I mean, the Jewish minority of Hebron, which was, as I said, 800 people, they lived amongst 20,000 Arabs, almost all of them Muslim, and the Jewish residents of Hebron were absolutely inferior. They were second-class citizens. Jews were forbidden from entering the Tomb of the Patriarchs and Matriarchs, the very reason for the existence of a Jewish community in Hebron was the fact that it's the burial place of Abraham and Leah and all of the patriarchs and matriarchs of the Jewish people. The Tomb of the Patriarchs was, of course, a fortress built by the Jewish king Herod in the first century atop the Cave of the Patriarchs, purchased by Abraham. And yet that very shrine was completely off limits to Jews. For 700 years under Muslim rule until 1967, only Muslims could enter the tomb. And Jews living in Hebron at the time were only permitted to pray as close as the seventh step. So they would enter, you know, and walk up to the seventh step, and they had to stop there. And they could only give their prayers through a hole in the wall. That was the closest they could get to the burial place of their forefathers and mothers. And that wasn't the only aspect of their being an inferior class in Hebron. The majority of this ancient Jewish community lived in a ghetto. So it was walled off. They would lock its doors at night to prevent any kind of attacks or, you know, any kind of trespassing at night. And, you know, yes, there were businesses owned by, you know, co-owned by Jews and Arabs. Jews and Arabs attended each other's weddings and holidays. And there was one Jew on Hebron City Council, but he was only one Jew on, you know, a council of dozens of men. And, you know, that was at the time a symbol of coexistence. I mean, in other majority Arab cities in Palestine, you didn't have any Jew on the city council. And so,
it wasn't a warm coexistence. I wonder what would happen if someone tried to go beyond the seventh step, sixth step, fifth step.
I mean, if somebody tried to go beyond the seventh step, he would be assaulted, beaten, perhaps even killed. Even Jews who obeyed these rules and prayed at the seventh step would sometimes have rocks thrown at their heads. They would sometimes be spat on. Jewish women who would go to pray outside the Tomb of the Patriarchs would sometimes be, you know, be cursed at or have, you know, really unpleasant experiences with young men who would say all kinds of things to them when they would go to pray there. And so, you know, even under these dynamics, it still wasn't perfect. Yeah. And rabbis would sometimes have their beards pulled by Arab children running past them. Elderly rabbis would sometimes be attacked on the streets. And, you know, it wasn't this perfect coexistence, but it was.
It existed.
Exactly. Yeah.
And I think this is an important thing for non-Jewish and Israeli, non-Israeli listeners viewers, because we imagine in the West peace and coexistence as some sort of summer camp around the fire singing, you know, Kumbaya and you know, and 60s folk songs. That's not what coexistence looks like in the Middle East. Coexistence means that both sides exist.
Right.
So let's talk about when both sides cease to exist together. Mm-hmm. The 1929 Hebron massacre. What were the main events that led to the massacre?
So the campaign of propaganda that led to this massacre on August 24th, 1929, a massacre that was eerily similar to the massacre of October 7th. It was a year-long campaign that began in 1928 around Yom Kippur, and it was instigated by the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, Haj Amin al-Husseini, who was at the time the most powerful Arab leader in Palestine. He was appointed by the British, who ruled Palestine at the time. It was the British Mandate of Palestine. When I say Palestine, that's what I'm referring to. And he began this rumor that will sound familiar to anyone who listens to this podcast, which is that the Jews were planning to destroy Al-Aqsa Mosque. That rumor began in 1928 when the Grand Mufti realized that he could quiet the dissent and criticism from his own people, where he had been accused of corruption, nepotism, misuse of religious funds. And he began this rumor that the Jews of Palestine were plotting to destroy Al-Aqsa Mosque to rebuild their ancient temple. So Al-Aqsa, for those who are unfamiliar, is built atop the ruins of the ancient Jewish temples in Jerusalem, atop the Temple Mount, the single holiest site in Judaism. At the time, in 1929, and for centuries before, the Temple Mount was off limits to Jews, kind of like the Tomb of the Patriarchs in Hebron, which is known to Arabs as the Ibrahimi Mosque. So the Temple Mount was completely off limits to non-Muslims.
Even nowadays, Jews can go and visit, but they cannot pray.
Exactly.
Which
so at
is the
time,
the
they couldn't
quo.
Even visit. The closest place they could go was the Kotel, the Western Wall. Today, we know the Kotel as this vast plaza where thousands of people could pray. At the time, it was this tiny little alleyway that was extremely claustrophobic. This was kind of another kind of aspect of how Jews were second-class citizens in Palestine under Muslim rule. This is another example. Arabs who lived near the Western Wall would often harass Jews who were praying at the Western Wall. They would throw their garbage there. Sometimes they would throw rocks at Jews below from Al-Aqsa because the Western Wall was right below it. And Jews kind of just put up with this for many years. And as Jewish immigration from Europe increased as a result of pogroms in Europe, Jews who were coming from Europe and expected to be coming to the Holy Land, to the ancient homeland of the Jewish people, expected to be able to pray at their holy places in peace, were really shocked by this and were complaining to the British authorities that they should protect Jewish worshipers, that they should do more to assist in Jewish access to the Western Wall, because the Mufti and other Arab leaders and Muslim officials were doing everything in their power to limit Jewish access to the Western Wall.
So how did the Grand Mufti, pre-internet, pre-TV, radio was even then was not something that every house had. How did he start this rumor? How did the rumor that the Jews are coming to take over what I believe is the third most sacred site of in Islam? How did that catch on?
So it's funny because we often think about disinformation as, a modern ailment, as a problem of social media. But, there was a very active Arabic press in Palestine. There were many different newspapers. The Husseini family, the Grand Mufti was from one of the most prominent and wealthiest families in Palestine at the time. They owned various newspapers, and he didn't even need the newspapers to spread that, because at the time, much of the population in Palestine, of the Arab population in Palestine, was illiterate. So what they did was spread these rumors, not just in the Arabic press for the literate population, but to the religious population, which was, the vast majority of Muslims in Palestine then and now are very religious. They attend mosques. And so in their sermons in mosques like Al-Aqsa or like the Ibrahimi Mosque in Hebron, imams were telling these lies that in Jerusalem, the Jews were plotting to destroy Al-Aqsa Mosque and rebuild their ancient temple. And in Hebron, they were repeating not only that lie, but also creating this rumor that the Jews in Hebron were planning to conquer Ibrahimi Mosque and take over the Tomb of the Patriarchs.
Was there any truth?
No.
Any inkling of this is why the rumor started?
So there was no truth to this rumor, but there were various actions taken by Jews in Palestine that kind of played into the Mufti's hands. Mm-hmm. So one of those is that in fundraising materials that the old yeshuv and even the new yeshuv would send to the Jewish diaspora, in these postcards and flyers asking for funding of the Jewish community in Eretz Yisrael, they would have these portraits of the Beit HaMikdash, the ancient temple in Jerusalem, similar to paintings some of us have today in our homes or in our grandparents' homes that show, you know, the Beit HaMikdash, the ancient temple in Jerusalem. And it was really just nostalgia. It was art. It was, you know, this was the reason that, you know, this is the glory of ancient Israel, the ancient temple. And yet those flyers and postcards were then used as proof by people like the Grand Mufti that the Jews of Palestine were working to raise funds for the rebuilding of the ancient temple.
So it's the same as if the indigenous people of the Americas would have like a drawing, a rendering of the Aztec temple, the Mayan temple, a Cherokee, town or village. And white supremacists would take that as proof, quote unquote, proof, Seaver coming to take over.
Exactly. And I mean, you know, these Islamic officials were very aware of the fact that within the Jewish faith, there is this belief in the arrival of the Mashiach and that, you know, through God's will, one day the temple will be rebuilt. And so they knew that they could use this desire, this ancient Jewish desire for the rebuilding of the temple as proof, if you will, of, you know, this Jewish plot to destroy Al-Aqsa. And this continues today. I mean, Israel has been in control of the land upon which Al-Aqsa stands since 1967, and Israel has not destroyed Al-Aqsa Mosque to rebuild the ancient temple. And yet this lie continues to galvanize so much, you know, rage, not within just within Palestinian society, but within the Muslim world as a whole. I mean,
we'll get to today, but we need to establish the past before we get to the present.
Yeah.
So eye towards the future.
So another example of how actions of the Jewish community in Palestine kind of played into these rumors and these lies was the fact that the Jewish population was really angry at the British for not doing more to counter this propaganda and this disinformation. After all, the Grand Mufti was a British official in a way. I mean, he was appointed by the British.
He wasn't their first choice, right?
Right. Well, yeah. He wasn't the most obvious choice, but he was, for inexplicable reasons, their first choice. I mean, there was an election for the Grand Mufti, for the position of Grand Mufti. Haj Amin al-Husseini's father had been Grand Mufti. His older brother had been Grand Mufti. But he himself was not an obvious choice for Grand Mufti. He had not finished the proper education that you would need to become Grand Mufti. He was not a sheikh. There were other candidates for the post who were much more qualified for the job and far less anti-Semitic, far less anti-Zionist, anti-British. He had actually already fled Palestine years earlier for inciting deadly riots in 1920 when the British wanted to arrest him, and he fled to Transjordan where he hid out with Bedouin tribes. And it was the first British High Commissioner of Palestine, a Jewish Zionist named Herbert Samuel, who decided to pardon the Mufti, welcome him, and also Jabotinsky had also been arrested for his actions in trying to defend Jewish communities from these earlier Arab attacks. So the British not only pardoned him, but then decided to appoint him for the post of Grand Mufti, which was the most powerful position for a Muslim official.
Why would they do that? Why did the British? Because if I'm not mistaken, and you recall this in your book, there was an election. He didn't come out first in the election, and yet he was chosen by the British. Why would the British choose the Haj Amin al-Husseini as the Grand Mufti?
So there, to this day, there hasn't been, you know, kind of a mea culpa by anyone in the British government as to why. But there was speculation, and Herbert Samuel's son actually said later on that he thinks his father wanted to keep their enemies closer. So, you know, this man, Hajji Amin al-Husseini, had already proven himself to be deeply anti-Zionist. And Herbert Samuel, of course, was a Zionist. He had been welcomed with open arms and celebrations by the Jewish community of Palestine when he came to Palestine as the first high commissioner. But the Arab community was much more suspicious of him for obvious reasons. And so his thinking
was,
okay.
Well, the obvious reasons is he was a Jew. Yeah. That it's obvious to you and I, it right. shouldn't be an obvious reason. We weren't suspicious of him because he was British. He was a Jew, and that was the problem. So,
and he was Zionist. So he favored the British official policy of establishing a Jewish home in Palestine, which was at the very core of the British mandate. I mean, the League of Nations, on behalf of the international community, had given the British the power to govern Palestine after conquering, after the Ottoman Empire had fallen apart with World War I, after siding with the Germans. And when the Ottoman Empire fell apart and the British and the French were given the right to control those former Ottoman territories by the League of Nations, built into that mandate for the British to rule Palestine was this promise of establishing not a Jewish state, but a Jewish home in Palestine, a place where Jews could be free from persecution, where they would live in equality with the rest of the population. Within the mandate, there was this vow that in establishing a Jewish home in Palestine, the rights of the Arab community would be protected, and they were protected. But the thing is, for the Arab leaders, such as the Grand Mufti, they were not interested in equality. They had been very happy with the state of affairs in which Jewish citizens of Palestine had been second-class citizens, and they wanted it to stay that way. And so the threat of Zionism wasn't this, you know, this threat to their livelihood. It was a threat to this dynamic in which Jewish subjects were, you know, they paid special taxes for being Jewish. They didn't have access to their holy sites, as we saw in Jerusalem and in Hebron. And Zionism threatened that kind of dominance of Islam in Palestine. And so the Grand Mufti, this rumor that he began was in a way his way of countering Zionism in the way that he knew best, because he knew that this weaponization of Islam, and specifically this weaponization of Al-Aqsa, and in Hebron, the weaponization of Ibrahimi Mosque and this supposed Jewish plot to conquer it, which had no validity whatsoever, that would work. And he was right. Much of the criticism just melted away once there was this scapegoat. We saw the tragic impact of that on August 24th, 1929.
So let's get to August 24th. Before that, I just, for people listening, and because as someone who is, I'm not a history buff, but I think history is our only way of figuring out what's going on. Just to give, people might be confused about all the facts and everything. So let me kind of draw the picture we've covered so far, and then we'll keep going. After the First World War, the British Empire was given a mandate over the land of Israel, or the land of what used to be ruled by the Ottoman Empire, of both east and west of the Jordan, to rule the land. They created Transjordania east of the Jordan, and then west of the Jordan was their mandate to ensure a Jewish homeland with equal rights. That's the only reason the British were there in the first place. 1920, 1921, there are deadly riots in Jaffa, Jerusalem, and other places in the land of Israel, the British Mandate of Palestine, led and instigated by this man, Hajji Amin al-Husseini. He flees to Jordan, hides with the Bedouins, then he's brought back by the British and appointed the Grand Mufti, like the highest role in the land. To me, it's almost like putting David Duke as the Archbishop. And he then uses religious fervor and fake news, basically, about the taking of Al-Aqsa, the mosque on the Temple Mount, to instigate the Hebron, 1929 Hebron massacre. And so we get to August 24, August 24, 1929. What happens?
So on August 23rd, 1929, one day before the massacre in Hebron, riots erupted in Jerusalem immediately after Friday prayers at Al-Aqsa Mosque, when imams called on the thousands of Muslim worshipers who had gathered there. They had been told to come to Friday prayers armed, and they did, and the British did not disarm them, although they had been warned.
They were told to come to prayer armed. That, I would say, no matter what your religion is, red flag. If someone tells you to come to church, synagogue, mosque, temple, anywhere else with a gun or a knife, or like, that's not a good sign.
The imam was armed. The imam, who was leading prayers, was waving a sword as he delivered his sermon. And in his sermon, he called on the faithful to defend Islam and Al-Aqsa with their blood. And armed worshipers flowed from the mosque in the thousands down to the old city, where they began to attack Jewish passersby, set fire to Jewish businesses. And these violent riots quickly engulfed Palestine, spreading from Jerusalem to every Jewish community in Palestine. And Jewish communities were either defended by the Haganah, the underground Jewish defense force that would later become the Haganah, the IDF, or they were evacuated by British authorities to places like Tel Aviv. So the Jewish communities of Gaza and elsewhere were evacuated by British forces, brought to Tel Aviv. In Hebron, as I mentioned earlier, this was this cradle of relative peace, let's call it, relative harmony compared to what we know today and what had existed in other parts of Palestine at the time. So much so that the Jewish leaders of Hebron had rejected offers of protection from the Haganah one day before the riots erupted. So on Thursday, August 22nd, 1929, the day before the riots.
For people listening in, just what is the Haganah?
The Haganah was this underground Jewish defense force founded about 1920 to defend Jewish communities in Palestine from increasing Muslim attacks.
Okay.
And so on August 22nd, 1929, members of the Haganah arrived in Hebron to meet with Jewish leaders of Hebron and warn them that riots were going to erupt. They had had undercover people. So there was actually this, what might be the first, Mossad agent long before the Mossad ever existed, one of the very few, if only Mizrahi members of the Haganah had already been doing, covert work, spending time in Al-Aqsa and other mosques and kind of embedding himself within the Muslim community in Jerusalem to find out what was being planned. And so he knew, and the Haganah knew, that riots were going to break out. They knew that, thousands of Muslims were going to be gathering at Al-Aqsa on August 23rd, and that they were going to attack Jewish communities across Palestine. So when members of the Haganah came to Hebron and warned them that there was going to be an attack on the Jewish community of Hebron, and that the Haganah wanted to either defend them and protect them in Hebron or bring them to Jerusalem to safety until the riots subsided, Jewish leaders of Hebron were unanimous in their opposition. They said, "Nothing is going to happen to us. Our Arab neighbors are our friends. They will never hurt us. If anything happens, to the Jewish communities in Jerusalem or elsewhere, we'll be fine. We were fine in 1920. We were fine in 1921. And that's because of these relations that we have with our Arab neighbors."
Sounds very much like some kibbutzim.
Yes. Yeah. A lot of. I mean, there are so many haunting parallels between the massacre of 1929 and October 7th, not to the atrocities themselves were, we'll get to that. So the Jewish leaders of Hebron told the Haganah to leave, and they did. And the Jewish community of Hebron was absolutely defenseless. I mean, these weren't Zionists building the foundations of a Jewish state. They were pious, religious Jews living a quiet, peaceful existence centered around the Torah. Many of them were rabbis, yeshiva students, and many of them, including many of those who were killed, were Arabic-speaking, Sephardi, Mizrahi Jews whose families had been there for centuries. Until the massacre of 1929, many of these Arabic-speaking Jews in Hebron considered themselves closer friends with their Arab Muslim neighbors than their Ashkenazi Jewish neighbors because they had more in common with their Muslim neighbors. They were extremely patriarchal, very conservative, very traditional. The protagonist in the first half of my book, David Shainberg, who traveled from Memphis to Hebron in 1928 and studied at the Hebron Yeshiva, in one of his first letters home to his parents, he said he couldn't tell some of the Jews between the Arabs. He said they dress alike, their wives wear veils like the Muslim women. So it was really, you know, I think that's what I mean when I speak about this, you know, unique dynamic in Hebron before the massacre, in which, you know, there were really friendly relations between the Arabs and Jews in Hebron. They owned businesses together. Many of the Jews who lived outside of the Jewish ghetto rented their homes from Arab landlords.
So let's get to the massacre. Unfortunately, we have to talk about it. What happened?
So because Hebron's Jewish community was absolutely defenseless, they could do nothing but hide in their homes and wait. The British police chief of Hebron, who oversaw a force of about 40 police officers, all but one of them were Arab men who either participated in the massacre or just stood by and allowed it to happen. He had told the Jewish leaders of Hebron, who finally understood that the warnings were true, that the Haganah was right. But by the time they realized that, it was too late. And when they went to the British police chief, the day the riots erupted in Jerusalem, he told them, just stay in your homes and I'll protect you. As long as you stay inside, you'll be safe. And so that's what they did. They waited. And this Jewish man on the Hebron City Council, Eliezer Slonim, who I mentioned earlier, because he had some of the best relations with the Arab community, his home was considered the safest place in Hebron. And so about 70 people had taken shelter in his home on the morning of August 24th, 1929, on Shabbat. It was the day after the riots had erupted in Jerusalem. And 3,000 Muslim men were marching through the Jewish quarter of Hebron with swords, axes, and daggers. And
how many Jews were there in Hebron at the time?
800. And there were 20,000 Muslims. So out of 20,000 Muslims, 3,000 participated in the riots. And that's just the men. Their wives and children, after they would slaughter people inside their homes, their wives and children would go into those homes and steal everything they could. This is taken directly from testimonies of survivors of the massacre who said they waited, pretending to be dead while they, you know, crouched in fear, waiting for these men to leave, you know, waiting in pools of blood. And then they watched their young people and women coming in with bags and sacks and taking everything of value they could find. But the massacre itself only lasted a couple of hours. And in those couple of hours, 67 unarmed Jewish men, women, and children, including infants, were slaughtered by their neighbors. And the atrocities were horrific. The British High Commissioner at the time, not Herbert Samuel, a different man, wrote in his diary after visiting Hebron that he had not seen, that he didn't think horrors like this had occurred in hundreds of years, perhaps since the Crusades, and he didn't think that, you know, humanity was capable of this kind of cruelty.
I want to delve into the cruelty for a second, and not out of any sensationalism, but because I think it's important to understand. And I want, for people listening or watching, maybe they can skip, if they don't want to, skip 30 seconds, a minute, 2 minutes. But it's important. What you say, slaughter, you say cruelty. That's almost editorializing. Let's lay out the facts. What happened?
So women and girls were raped. Sometimes they were killed after they were raped. Other times they survived. Infants were slaughtered in their mother's arms. One mother was holding her baby when a man cut off his head. This was a child of less than 1 year old. The mother passed out when It happened, and when she woke up, her son was dead, and her husband beside her was also dead. And she recognized the man who killed her husband and son as one of the local municipality workers, you know, a lamplighter, I think it was. Children watched as their parents were butchered by their neighbors. Many people had their limbs cut off. Stomachs were cut open. One man had his head burnt over his stove. He was burnt alive. The physician who had treated, who had worked at the Hadassah Clinic, this was a Jewish clinic that had provided free treatment to needy Arabs and Jews alike. The pharmacist of 40 years. He had an amputated leg because he had fallen down a staircase while treating an Arab patient years earlier. He lived right next to the clinic, and he was slaughtered before the eyes of his children and wife, and his eyes were gouged out. His daughter was raped before his eyes. His wife was killed. Their five children became orphans that day, and there were many orphans that day. And, you know, aside from the 67 Jewish men, women, and children who were killed, there were also dozens who were wounded, you know, who had fingers cut off. When the Jews of Hebron buried these men, women, and children, they also buried, you know, in Jewish practice, they buried body parts. And when that burial took place, the British had actually forced Arabs who had been arrested over the course of the massacre. They had arrested Arab men who had participated in the massacre, and they forced those men to dig the grave that would be this mass grave for those who were killed. And the British didn't understand Arabic, so they didn't know that these men were singing and celebrating. They didn't understand what they were saying, but they were celebrating their slaughter. The Jews of Hebron understood Arabic, and they told the British police chief and the British officials who were overseeing this mass grave being dug. And they said, you know, they're singing and celebrating their attack. And the British kind of just told them, as it was very symbolic of the way the British had reacted to much of these Jewish complaints of the previous year, complaining of, you know, the disinformation campaign, the limit of limiting Jewish access to the Western Wall. The British said, oh, you know, it's helping them work. So they allowed them to keep singing. And, you know, the British only allowed 10 men to attend the funeral of these people. They didn't want any other kinds of, you know, they didn't want a counterattack. The British.
So they let the murderers sing and celebrate, but we didn't let the Jews mourn. Sounds eerily familiar.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things I can't get out of my mind is that on August 24, 1929, my grandfather was a month and 4 days old in Haifa. And how they must have, you know, it's my great grandparents, you know, the news coming out of Hebron. So 67 people were murdered. How many of them American citizens?
Eight. So there were eight American citizens, but about 25 yeshiva students. Yeah. And many of those killed were also some of these Arabic-speaking Jews who had considered themselves closer friends with their Arab neighbors than with, you know, the Ashkenazi community of Hebron. And that changed in Hebron after...
But before the change, there were also really important stories of heroism.
Yes.
By Muslim Arabs risking their own lives, saving Jews. One of those stories that really touched you when you were doing research?
So the one that stands out for me is the story of a man named Abu Shaker. He was renting his home to the chief Ashkenazi rabbi of Hebron, Rabbi Yaakov Yosef Slonim, who I mentioned earlier was one of the people responsible for bringing the Slobodka Yeshiva to Hebron, along with his son, Eliezer Dan Slonim, who was killed on August 24th, 1929. His father, Rabbi Slonim, his story kind of symbolized the opposite end of the spectrum of humanity that we saw on August 24th, 1929. So while his son and his son's wife and child were killed in these riots, he himself, the chief rabbi, was saved by his Arab landlord who stood outside his home and told the mob, "You'll have to, you will only enter over my dead body." And he was in his 70s. He had actually literally—
He rode in with a horse, right?
He literally arrived on a white horse from his vineyards. His son had come to the vineyards and told him that this massacre was taking place. And he arrived on his white horse, stood guard outside of the house, and would not leave until he was sure that no one was going to return to that home to kill the Jews inside. And it wasn't just the chief rabbi of Hebron who was hiding in his home. It was 30 others, including his own children. And they were all saved that day, and they weren't the only ones. Actually, more Jews were saved that day by their Muslim neighbors than those who were killed. So 67 were killed, at least 200 were rescued by their Muslim neighbors. And I say at least because there are differing counts. There are various lists that were kept of the Arabs who saved Jews that day. Some of them count as many as 400 who were saved by their Muslim neighbors. And, you know, they either hid them inside their homes, in their attics or cellars. Others, like Abu Shakar, stood outside and told the mob, you know, they would not be able to enter unless they were going to kill them first. And
I think that's extremely important to remind people whenever a horror occurs, it shows the worst in humanity and it shows the best in humanity. What happens next? What are the consequences of the 1929 Hebron massacre?
Well, the British evacuated the Jewish community of Hebron and didn't just evacuate it. You know, in other places, Jews were evacuated, but then they went back. In Hebron, they were told not to come back. The British had proved incapable or unwilling to protect the Jewish community of Hebron. And
wait, so let's you're so poised, and I love that. But let's analyze that for a second. The Jewish community, the tiny Jewish community of Hebron, was slaughtered, evacuated. When they wanted to come back, the British told them, "You can't."
Yes. It actually wasn't just the British. The Zionist leadership in Palestine at the time didn't want the Jews to go back because they feared that they would be attacked again and they didn't have the capacity to protect them. The Haganah at the time was not the IDF. I mean, the Haganah would eventually, by 1948, formed the nucleus of the IDF. But at the time, the Haganah was extremely decentralized. It was, you know, this ragtag group of people just trying to defend Jewish communities.
It drives me crazy. It's like saying, we found the perfect solution to prevent rape. Stay at home.
Yeah.
No one in their sensible mind would say that is a solution. That is putting the onus on the victim.
And yet that isn't where the victim blaming ends, far from it. In the immediate aftermath of the massacre in Hebron, the Arab leadership and the Arabic press not only denied that these atrocities had taken place in Hebron, but blamed them on their Jewish victims. There was one...
So they didn't happen, and if they happened, it was their fault?
Okay. There was actually this one statement put out by the Arab leadership, the Arab executive, it was called, and the higher Arab committee. They claimed that the atrocities committed in Hebron and the casualties were a result of violence carried out by Jewish yeshiva students who wanted to raise funds from the diaspora by basically plotting this attack that they could then blame on the Arab community. And, you know, in Arabic newspapers throughout Palestine, they were claiming that the riots didn't start with Arab attacks in Jerusalem on August 23rd, but in fact with Jewish attacks on Muslim worshipers at Al-Aqsa, which was completely false, counter to all of the reporting, all of the British official statements. And the British officials were not, you know, on the side of the Jews here. I mean, they did so much to, you know, in terms of their failure to protect the Jews. They censored the Hebrew press in the immediate aftermath of the massacre because they feared, you know, this backlash. They're afraid of the backlash against
what backlash?
This.
Like, okay, the Arab press can, freedom of press can say what they want. Why can't the Jewish press, Hebrew press say, we were slaughtered, raped, massacred, mutilated, tortured?
So they did that, but only a week after, when there's censorship for not just the Arabic press, sorry, not just the Jewish press, but also communication lines were cut throughout Palestine, because I think they feared a mass rebellion by their Jewish subjects against this utter failure to protect them, not only on that day, you know, in terms of like physically protecting them, but for an entire year, the Jewish community in Palestine had been warning the British against this disinformation campaign surrounding Al-Aqsa, against the actions taken to prevent Jews from accessing the Western Wall. We didn't discuss this earlier, but the Mufti had paired his disinformation campaign with this very successful, sadly, campaign to prevent Jewish access to the Western Wall by instituting building projects there. So he had a door built into the Western Wall that allowed Muslims to access Al-Aqsa through the Western Wall. And that was clearly a tactic to increase the friction and increase the likelihood of attacks on Jewish worshipers at the Western Wall and to prevent them from being able to pray in peace at the Western Wall. And their reaction to that effort worked into the Mufti's campaign of disinformation, because to protest against the British failure to protect them, they were urging the British to give the Jewish community ownership of the Western Wall. The Western Wall at the time was owned by the Muslim Waqf, which the Mufti oversaw.
Yeah.
And so they were calling on the British to give the Western Wall to the Jewish community so that the Jewish community could pray at the holiest place accessible to them. So, you know, in the immediate aftermath of the massacre, the Arabic press continued to publish and continued to publish disinformation, claiming that the Jews in Hebron had carried out the attack, and in other places as well. So there was also a massacre in Sfat. It was much smaller, fewer casualties, but very similar. You know, the atrocities were.
I'm sorry, I have to say, that's a very Jewish thing of you to say. Yeah, there was another massacre, but it was a smaller one, so it's okay.
I'm not saying it was okay,
but like we're downplaying a massacre because it wasn't as big.
No, totally. It was horrific.
Was anyone held accountable for the 1929 Hebron massacre?
It's a good question. So the British carried out widespread arrests of Arab participants. Thousands were arrested, but very soon they were set free. Those who were tried and convicted had their sentences commuted to, you know, the basically non-existent. So, for instance, a sheikh in Hebron, who had been the ringleader of the attacks in Hebron, he received a sentence of 3 months. He served just days of that sentence, and he continued to be the highest Islamic official in Hebron. He was an associate of the Grand Mufti. The Grand Mufti, despite the—
I want to get to the Grand Mufti. I do want to show, because this is a really incredible book, and you know, I just loved it from the moment I started reading it. It also has incredible pictures. There's a picture here. I'll show it for people watching on YouTube. I'll show the picture and then I'll describe what we're seeing. It's a picture of it. The caption is "The Hebron Riots on August 24, 1929." Just to remind you, and it's just hundreds of people, civilians. There's one man, I think he's on someone else's shoulders wielding a sword, many men wielding swords and sticks, and just and there's some children being held there by their parents. This wasn't a military operation. This is just civilians who've decided we're going to slaughter our neighbors. And almost none of them paid the price for that. But then we get to the other picture of it, kind of like really threw me off, because I've seen pictures of the Grand Mufti meeting with Hitler in the late 1930s, early 1940s. What I haven't seen is this picture, and I'll show this one again to the camera for people watching in. It's a picture of the Grand Mufti. He's basically observing Nazi SS recruits as they are standing in line, standing in formation, and giving them the Hitler salute.
These were his own recruits.
These were his own.
The Mufti recruited as many as 100,000 Muslims to fight for the Nazis. Many of them served in the Waffen-SS. Many of them were involved in the slaughter of Jews in Croatia and Hungary. Many of them were recruited from Bosnia and Herzegovina. The Mufti was actually placed on the UN's list of Nazi war criminals at the end of World War II. He was wanted for Nazi war crimes. He had fled Palestine and found refuge in Berlin, living in a Nazi-financed estate from 1941 to 1945. He was the Nazis' leading voice in the Arab world, delivering Nazi propaganda broadcasts throughout the Arab world and writing Arabic brochures for Nazi recruits who were Muslim and fought for the Waffen-SS.
He orchestrated the Farhud.
Yeah. Before he went to Berlin, he was in Iraq. And he led the Arab branch of Joseph Goebbels' Ministry of Propaganda. He was a very effective propagandist. I mean, he had been extremely successful with his propaganda campaign in the Land of Israel, in British Mandate Palestine. And Hitler considered the Mufti an honorary Aryan. He had blue eyes, fair skin, ginger hair. He was, you know, this was the first leader of the Palestinian people. And one of the most surprising.
We have to remember one thing. 1945, the war ends. We have the Nuremberg trials. Rudolf Hess is tried. Goering is tried, kills himself in prison. Goebbels killed himself in the bunker. Hitler killed himself in the bunker. The Mufti doesn't face any trial.
No, he lived an open life until his death. In 1974, he never had to take on some kind of, you know, fake name, living in hiding. He lived out in the open after fleeing Berlin, you know, fleeing Nazi war crimes. Fleeing prosecution for Nazi war crimes. He took
refuge in.
I think
we can say he was fleeing his act in the Nazi war crimes.
Yes.
There's no alleged here.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
No, he wasn't, you know, a Nazi accomplice. He was a Nazi. He knew full well what was happening. He visited concentration camps. He was friends with Himmler. He knew about the Final Solution. And not only that, he actually urged different leaders in Europe to keep their Jewish population from fleeing the borders and ending up in Palestine. He didn't want them to get to Palestine. He said, send them to Poland. He knew what was happening in Poland. Yeah.
So what happened with him after 1945? How did he flee? How did the US, the British, all the so-called good people in the world, why did they let him off the hook?
It's a great question. He fled first to France, where the French did not, sent him away for prosecution. They protected him. They didn't want to anger their Arab allies. With the help of various Arab diplomats, he made his way from France to Cairo, where he would be, in good company. Many Nazis ended up fleeing to Cairo. And after spending time in Cairo, where he was introduced to his cousin Yasser Arafat, who became his apprentice, they both ended up leaving Cairo and moving to Beirut, which is where he ended up passing away in 1974. But that was only after leading a jihad against the Jews of Palestine. So he, you know, his work, if you will call it that, in Palestine didn't end with 1929, didn't end with him fleeing to Iraq and then Berlin. He continued to pull the strings of the jihad in Palestine from Beirut. And he created what he called Mujahideen Army, an army of the holy war, to carry out his jihad against the Jews of Palestine immediately after the 1947 UN vote to partition Palestine into an Arab state and a Jewish state. So,
I do want to ask you, and it's a tricky question because neither you nor I are Palestinian. You have covered, you were a journalist in Israel for 10 years. You covered a lot of conflicting issues. How do Palestinian people make sense of the fact that their first leader, the first, you know, known leader as the Palestinian people, back then it was Arabs of the land, but Palestinian leader orchestrated massacres against the Jews, then became a very high ranking official in the Nazi regime and recruited 100,000 Muslims to fight for the Nazis. And then that his nephew became their second leader, Yasser Arafat. How do they make sense of that?
I don't think they do make sense of it because I think most of them don't know. First of all, the vast majority of the Palestinians I spoke to about the massacre of 1929 had either never heard of it, or if they did know about it, they were much older and they denied the very facts of it, continuing to regurgitate the same propaganda that was put out in the immediate aftermath of the massacre, which was that it wasn't the Arabs who committed the massacre. Today, they're not blaming it on the Jews of Hebron. They're blaming it on the British, saying that the British made them do it, or the British were the ones who actually carried out these attacks. And in terms of the Mufti, he is still revered as, you know, a hero of the Palestinian people. The Palestinian Authority and Mahmoud Abbas honor him as, you know, a glorious leader of the Palestinian people, but they don't talk about his role in the Holocaust. It's just not spoken about. And I don't think that's surprising, given the fact that I didn't know about the Grand Mufti's role during the Holocaust. I knew that he had met with Hitler, but I didn't really know to the extent of his involvement in the Holocaust. And, you know, the Holocaust itself is a deeply taboo subject within Palestinian society and the wider Muslim world. It's not really something that is spoken about. And so I think that it's just not really a part of Palestinian history that Palestinians really are aware of. And so they're not reckoning with it. And I think it really should be more well known.
And there's a lot to talk about. Let me fast forward because just for the listeners, in 1967, the Six-Day War, Israel occupied, took over, some people say liberated, depending on your partisanship, but basically took over Hebron. Mm-hmm. It was the first time that Jews could pray inside Ma'arat HaMachpelah, the tomb of the patriarchs and matriarchs. And when, you know, then became part of the Western Bank, the Palestinian territories. Then comes something that I remember as a child, young teen, 1994, Baruch Goldstein.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens there?
So in February of 1994, Baruch Goldstein, a Brooklyn-born doctor who was living in Kiryat Arba, it's a settlement on the outskirts of Hebron. He had been a close follower of the late Rabbi Meir Kahana, whose party Kach was later outlawed as a terrorist organization in Israel as a result of this. As a direct result of Baruch Goldstein's attack in 1994. So before his attack, Kach had been labeled as racist and Kahana had been banned from running for election, but it hadn't been labeled a Jewish terrorist organization in Israel. It was a direct result of this attack by a disciple of Kahana, Baruch Goldstein, who went into the Tomb of the Patriarchs and Matriarchs, Ma'arat HaMechpelah, one of the holiest places in Judaism, burial place in Islam as well. And he went into the Hall of Isaac. This is one of the largest sites of Islamic prayer within the shrine. It's a massive shrine. There's the Hall of Abraham. The Hall of Isaac was where they were holding Ramadan prayer. So he walked into this massive hall where hundreds of men and boys were praying. They were bowing down at the time, and he opened fire, killing 29 men and teenage boys. And he was killed by survivors of his attack who overtook him and beat him to death. But 29 were killed.
Murdered.
Yes, murdered. And he had managed to walk in to the Tomb of the Patriarchs and Matriarchs armed because he was a reservist in the army. He was a he was a doctor. He was an army doctor. He had been a paramedic in Hebron for years. And people who defend his actions say that he had been witnessing, you know, victims of Palestinian terrorism for months at that point. This was 1994. This was in the aftermath of the Oslo Accords when Hamas and other terrorist groups were carrying out suicide bombings and attacks, wide-scale attacks on Jews to derail the peace process. And in Hebron and in Kiryat Arba and in surrounding areas, Baruch Goldstein had been attending to victims of this terrorism. And so, you know, obviously, I do not agree with anyone who defends his actions in that way.
Let's be even clearer here. There's nothing defensible about this.
Of course. You know,
I can't imagine what a first responder sees, and I applaud every first responder, but there are dozens, if not hundreds of first responders. The vast majority of them never take violence against innocent people. There's nothing defensible.
Exactly. And yet, sadly today, as I learned from my conversations with Israeli settlers who live in Hebron, many of them defend his actions that way, saying, oh, but there had been so many terrorist attacks, and oh, but Arabs were planning to attack Jews in Hebron. None of that justifies what he did. I mean, this thinking that a violent attack is going to prevent other violent attacks, especially something that to this day is so paramount in the minds of Palestinians in Hebron, this massacre in 1994, often when I would ask—
And most, the vast majority of Jews in Israel.
Yes, that's very important to note, because in 1994, when he carried out this attack, it was— just unanimously, you know, offensive to all Israelis, whether it was the president of Israel, lawmakers from right and left denounced his actions, and rabbis throughout Israel were horrified by what he did, and Israeli society was unanimous in its opposition to this attack. Sadly, you know, I found that when I would speak to Palestinians in Hebron about, you know, terrorist attacks or about, you know, the 1929 massacre, it wasn't, you know, there was never this, you know, denunciation of it. You know, it was either denial, you know, efforts to justify it, to rationalize it. And, you know, I think that's really important to note. I mean, I think that, you know, today so many people speak about the, you know, violence by settlers in the West Bank as if it's something that is, you know, unanimous of, you know, or representative of all settlers in the West Bank. You know, there is definitely violence happening in the West Bank, and there are definitely violent settlers. But this idea that those people represent the majority of settlers in the West Bank is not true. And I think I was actually guilty of this thinking as well before I started writing this book. I had the impression that all settlers in Hebron are, you know, these violent, radical people. And I found that the vast majority of them just want to live in peace. I actually found that many of the Palestinians and Jews in Hebron are very similar at the end of the day. You know, they are living there for the same reason, because they revere Abraham. They want to live near the burial place of the forefathers and mothers of the Jewish people, of the Arabic people. Abraham is seen as the patriarch of the Arab
and
people
as well,
and the Christian people as well. And so, you know, they live these very spiritual lives. They're very connected to their land. You know, this the one of the Palestinian families that I spent a lot of time with, they have this beautiful orchard of ancient olive trees in their yard, and they, you know, keep chickens in their backyard, and they're just so proud of, you know, and so connected to the land upon which they live. And, you know, across the street from them, the Jewish settlers who live there also, you know, very connected to their land. They grow wheat in their backyard. They celebrate the, you know, different Jewish holidays that are connected to the land of Israel and, you know, the harvesting seasons. And so I was always struck by how similar they were, and yet how far apart they are as a result of so much of this, you know, extremist rhetoric that sadly, you know, kind of drives both sides.
I need to make a note, one important note. This is a very important and hefty book. It took you 5 years to write. You started writing this before the October 7th massacre. Obviously, a lot of things have changed in the writing. The final chapters are just incredible. I don't want to give anything away. People will have to read the book to really get the full experience of those final chapters. And for the sake of time, we'll have to be short on this. But if you could note the top 3 to 5 commonalities between the 1929 Hebron massacre and the October 7th massacre, what would be those commonalities?
So one is the atrocities themselves were chillingly similar. The cruelty with which people were killed. Second is the role of Al-Aqsa and disinformation surrounding it. I mean, it's no coincidence that Hamas named its attack on October 7th the Al-Aqsa Flood and continued to use Al-Aqsa. If you recall, in the months after October 7th, they tried to open new fronts in the war, whether it was with Muslim citizens of Israel or Palestinians in the West Bank, urging them to flood Al-Aqsa, hoping that that flood would cause, a new front in the war in the West Bank or in Israel. Thankfully, that didn't happen. But this use of Al-Aqsa and the imagery of Al-Aqsa plays such a galvanizing role, unfortunately, in the Palestinian consciousness. And that has been used by corrupt Palestinian leaders since the Grand Mufti. I mean, Hamas is as corrupt as it gets. So is the Palestinian Authority. And both of them, despite the fact that the Palestinian Authority is seen as, a much more secular, moderate force, they too have used this lie about this supposed Jewish plot to destroy Al-Aqsa to distract their people from their inability to extricate the Palestinian people from perpetual poverty, their inability to offer them a better life, a better future, any kind of hope for the future. And of course, I mean, the parallels between the denial and victim blaming that followed October 7th and 1929 cannot be ignored. I mean, we saw in the most intimate of ways, especially you did at Columbia, the way in which the perpetrators of October 7th were both celebrated as heroes, their atrocities were denied and blamed on Israel, both indirectly and directly. So there are those who say, Israel killed its own citizens on October 7th, the same way that Arab leaders in the Arabic press claimed that Jews in Hebron had killed each other in 1929. And then there's the more indirect victim blaming, which is, the international community today saying, oh, well, the attacks didn't happen in a vacuum. And, you have to understand the suffering, or, they blame, the blockade of Gaza, which, of course, wasn't only instituted by Israel since it was sharing a border with a terrorist organization vowing to destroy it. But that blockade was also instituted by Egypt. And you don't see anybody saying that Gazans should go and massacre Egyptians.
You don't see Egyptians being slaughtered by
exactly.
Hamasniks.
Exactly. And, that victim blaming by the international community that we see today, it also happened in 1929 when the British responded to the riots of 1929 by issuing new policies that vastly limited Jewish immigration and land purchases in Palestine. I mean, people often talk about Israel or, the Jews stealing Palestinian land. That didn't happen. The land was never stolen. It was purchased legally by Arab landlords who often sold their land at extremely inflated prices, and then went to their people and complained about Zionism or about Jewish land sales, which they were doing themselves and profiting from. So this kind of disinformation and propaganda that was very active and very destructive in 1929 continues to this day from the very same forces.
I would add one last thing. If you look at Meir Kahane's speaking and writing in the 70s and 80s, it's very much draws from the 1929 Hebron massacre, which then inspired the extremist terrorist act by Baruch Goldstein in Hebron. I think what we're seeing now is that the October 7th massacre is being used by extremist factions within the Jewish world to reinvigorate that Kahanism thinking and extremism, fighting violence with violence, hatred with hatred, and extremism with extremism. The irony of it all is that before 1967, Jews could not pray higher than the seventh stair. Since the massacre by Baruch Goldstein, Jews are restricted, and Palestinians, Arabs are restricted in the tomb of the patriarchs and matriarchs. So extremism on either side and hatred on either side is just blocking all sides from just living their full lives.
Exactly. I mean, and I write about this in the book in the same way that the massacre of 1929 really transformed Zionism and rallied the Jewish community of Palestine around Zionism and strengthened Zionism. We see how the forces of October 7th have strengthened the right wing in Israel, too. I mean, there's so many of the people who were killed and kidnapped on October 7th were left-wing Israelis. They were peace activists, people who had spent years trying to help civilians in Gaza. And the fact that the most peaceful of Israelis were those who were targeted on October 7th has led many formerly left-wing Israelis to shift further to the right. And we've seen how, you know, the attacks of October 7th, just like the attacks of 1929, have kind of galvanized Israeli society and the Jewish diaspora or diaspora around, you know, kind of like a stronger version of Zionism that recognizes that the world is not going to help us, only we can help ourselves. And I think that, you know.
But let's be clear. You can be a strong Zionist without being a lefty or a right-wing Zionist.
Exactly.
You can be a strong Zionist without being a violent Zionist. And in fact, one thing that I love about this book is that it is as likely to anger right-wingers as it is to anger left-wingers, because it's the truth, and the truth doesn't pander to anyone's politics. We can talk a lot more about this book, and you know that this is the first time I'm meeting an author of a book that I loved before I knew the author. So this is just incredible. I just recommend to everyone, Jewish or not Jewish, who just wants to understand more what's happening, read this book.
Thank you so much.
So we're going to end with the Here I Am lightning round, a series of rapid fire questions. First thing that comes to mind. No, don't think too much about it.
Okay.
Yordana Schwartz, what is one thing people don't know about you?
I have two kids that I gave birth to while writing this book. My youngest, his name is Lior. He was born in Be'er Sheva. And my oldest, Ayala, was born in Tel Aviv. Being a mother is my proudest achievement.
What is one thing people don't know about the Jews?
That we are indigenous to the land of Israel, that the name Judaism comes from the kingdom of Judah, which was renamed Palestine by the Roman conquerors who were punishing Jewish rebels in the first century. But our name speaks for itself. The Jews are indigenous.
What is your favorite curse?
My favorite curse, I guess, fuck.
When was the last time you cried?
Wow. I think when my Saba, my grandfather, died right before my book was published. And that was why I dedicated it to him.
What was his name?
Ken Cohen.
Saba Ken?
Saba Ken, yeah. Right. The book is dedicated to him.
If you could have any Jewish person over for Shabbat dinner from any moment in history, dead or living, who would that be?
Golda Meir. Easy.
Easy. A lot of people mentioned Golda.
I bet.
What is your favorite Jewish holiday?
I think Purim.
What is your least favorite Jewish holiday?
Passover.
When do you feel safest?
When I'm in my home with my kids, but especially in Israel.
When do you feel least safe?
I don't know.
That's a good answer. That's a good answer. Not having that silence of like, I don't know, and I feel safe either versus too many times or not enough. That's good. Yeah. What gives you hope?
Gives me hope. The student leaders, the Jewish student leaders on campuses who have taken a stand against the vile disinformation and hatred of Jews on campuses and have not bowed in, to fear and have stood up regardless of whether they had backing from organizations or money behind them and didn't give up and sued the schools and saw justice. You know, much of the results we've seen in the last year and a half from, you know, task forces or, you know, universities actually doing their job in the face of anti-Semitism is the result of these student activists who took them to court and won.
Finally, every episode, I urge the listeners to donate to one charity that does good in Israel, the Jewish diaspora, or the world in general. Where would you want people to donate to this week?
I think the Hostage and Families Forum, the families of the hostages, they can always use our help.
Yardena, where can people find you?
I'm on Instagram, Yardena S, and Twitter. And my website is yardenaschwartz.com. You can see my work, my journalistic work, reviews of the book, and see links to buy the book.
All right. And you can find the book, Ghosts of a Holy War, the 1929 massacre in Palestine that ignited the Arab-Israeli conflict, in every bookstore.
Thank you so much.
Yardena, I had a pleasure reading your book. I had a pleasure speaking with you. I can't wait for you to write another book. And I'm just delighted to say, here I am with Yardena Schwartz.
Thank you so much. Really an honor.
Hi, I'm Michael Greenspan, Shai's father-in-law. I'd like to thank you for listening to the Here I Am podcast with Shai Davidai. Here I Am is recorded at the Cave Production House in Hackensack, New Jersey, and is brought to you in partnership with Abby Sophia and Adamit Productions. You can find us on Instagram, YouTube, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. I'd also like to extend my deepest gratitude to everyone at Adamit Productions for turning Shai's dream into a reality, and to all our donors and partners for their unwavering commitment to fighting for Jewish civil rights. Most importantly, I'd like to thank you, our listeners. Let's be honest, none of this would have been possible without your support and dedication. Showing up is half the battle. Thank you for showing up. Thank you for being there. Thank you for saying, "Here I am."